Debunking Preterism by Dr. Brock D. Hullett, Chapter 5, The Beginning of Birth Pains. Ancient rabbis, following the Old Testament prophets, taught that the birth pains of the Messiah would be a period of increasing distress and tribulation that would come upon the Jewish nation and the world prior to the arrival of God's kingdom. In the Olivet Prophecy, the Lord Jesus began answering the apostles' questions by reminding them that the birth pains must arrive before the end. See that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains. See that you are not led astray, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and the time is at hand. Do not go after them. And when you hear of wars and tumults, do not be terrified, for these things must first take place, but the end will not be at once. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, and in various places famines and pestilences, and there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. Those are from Matthew 24:4-8 and Luke 21:8-11. Many events that occurred at the end of the first century AD could be said to represent the conditions that Jesus termed the beginning of the birth pains. To illustrate, the New Testament and the Jewish historian Josephus related accounts of false Christs and false prophets. Several battles, civil wars, and rumors of wars raged throughout the Roman Empire. In addition, St. Luke relayed that a famine plagued the empire, especially Judea, Acts 11:27-29. Also, during the years leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem, famines occurred in Rome and throughout Greece, and several earthquakes took place. Many Jews within the vicinity of the Jerusalem temple felt an earthquake during this period. Furthermore, two comets streaked across the empire in AD 60. Finally, Josephus recorded the arrival of ominous signs, including a star resembling a sword, lightning storms above the temple, and chariots and armor-clad soldiers in the clouds over Jerusalem. Preterists present this historical evidence as proof of preterism. However, it should be noted that these catastrophic events occur in every period of history. Damar admits no less, explaining that wars, earthquakes, famines, and plagues have been a part of the human condition since the fall. This means that their contemporary manifestation does not necessarily carry any prophetic importance. On one level, the normative nature of these initial portents, the beginning of the birth pains, evidences that they do not signal the end of the age. Chilton concurred, in themselves, Jesus warned, they were not to be taken as signals of an imminent end. Gentry argues that Jesus used the phrase, the beginning of birth pains, to warn against false starts concerning the end, and that this phrase has no specific reference and is not reserved for final eschatological events. He explains in detail, quote, in my fuller analysis of the text, I will show that early in the discourse, he warns them not to become confused by preliminary signs, for that is not yet the end, Matthew 24:6b, and all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs, Matthew 24:8. So in answering their question regarding when will these things be, he cautions them against being misled by the initial signs. This means he is in fact answering their questions as to when these things will be, but has not arrived at the answer yet. Jesus warned against a premature identification of the initial signs as prophetic harbingers of the eschaton because these events occur in every period. Nevertheless, scriptures predict an intensification of these labor pains in the years leading up to the end of the age. To illustrate, the apocalypse predicts a slurry of hail, fire, and blood destroying a third of all trees and all grass, a fiery mountain killing a third of marine life, a falling star poisoning a third of the rivers and tributaries, and a thick darkness blocking the visibility of the sun, moon, and stars for a third of people, Revelation 8:7-12. The Apostle John also foresaw that a falling star will open a large shaft in the earth, resulting in smoke darkening the atmosphere, Revelation 9:1-2. In addition, he described a terrifying earthquake of unprecedented magnitude, Revelation 6:12-17, 16:18-21. None of these events took place in the first century, but this has not deterred many preterists from engaging in exegetical gymnastics to argue that they did occur. Jesus continued his discourse by enumerating other events that would continue the birth pains of tribulation. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another, and many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. Matthew 24:9-13. Preterist correctly notes that the book of Acts relates that the apostles and other early disciples were persecuted, which included threats, beatings, legal accusations, flogging, imprisonment, and martyrdom for their faithfulness to the gospel. However, Luke's parallel account of the Olivet Discourse includes the phrase, "But before all this," Luke 21:12, which notifies the reader that this persecution would begin before the beginning of sorrows described in the preceding verses, Luke 21:8-11. Furthermore, the writings of the Holy Church Fathers confirm that this persecution continued unabated for many centuries beyond the era of the apostles, and preterists admit that Christians have been intensely persecuted for nearly 2,000 years. These facts argue against the limited specificity advocated by preterism, namely that Jesus spoke only about a limited persecution that occurred prior to AD 70. The portion of the Olivet Discourse discussed above should be understood as a warning about the persecution and tribulation that Christians have experienced during the interadventual period. This understanding is strengthened by Jesus' explanation that this tribulation will reach a new level of intensity once the abomination of desolation is seen standing in the holy place of the temple, which prohibits the reader from equating this earlier tribulation with the unprecedented and unequaled tribulation that will occur immediately before the end of the age. The Apostle John also differentiated between the general tribulation experienced by believers and the Great Tribulation. He saw a vision where the souls of the martyrs were instructed to rest a little longer until their fellow Christians experienced martyrdom during the Great Tribulation. The biblical evidence indicates that the initial labor pains of tribulation will intensify and reach a crescendo as the end approaches, consistent with Christ's statement that the end will not be at once, Luke 21:9. The Gospel to the Entire World. Jesus continued his Olivet Discourse by prophesying about a worldwide preaching of the gospel prior to the end. He explained that this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Preterists argue that the Greek word translated world here is a technical term which refers to the civilized world of the Roman Empire. They contend that the apostolic gospel had already been proclaimed throughout all nations throughout the empire, and they support these claims by appealing to the Apostle Paul's statements. Your faith is proclaimed in all the world, Romans 1:8. There, the heavens, voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world, Romans 10:18. For your obedience is known to all, the gospel has been made known to all nations, Romans 16:19-26. The gospel which has come to you, as indeed in the whole world, it is bearing fruit and increasing. It has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, Colossians 1:5-6-23. Several objections can be made to this preterist interpretation of these passages. First, unlike the verse under consideration, whole world, Matthew 24:14, these Pauline passages simply cannot be understood literally, but should be taken hyperbolically. The apostle utilized exaggeration in these verses to emphasize the evangelistic success of the gospel, and his companion Luke also employed similar hyperbolic expressions. For example, Paul explained that devout Jews from every nation under heaven were staying in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, Acts 2:5. Certainly, the reader should not demand that Jews from Bithynia or Armenia, much less the Han Dynasty, were in town for the festival. Similarly, unbelieving Jews accused Paul and his traveling companions of turning the world upside down with the gospel, Acts 17:6. In these passages, it is inappropriate to render these expressions literally. The Apostle Paul used hyperbole in the above verses, a point that becomes apparent when we consider how he employed a different Greek term than Jesus did in Matthew 24:14 in all but one of those references. First, Paul substituted world for earth or land in Colossians 1:5-6, and this is an allusion to Genesis 1:28 in the Septuagint, a verse that speaks of God's command for mankind to multiply and subdue the entire created world, that is, the earth. In other words, this verse is not limited to a limited geographical region. Instead, the apostle alluded to this text in the Colossians passage to show that the gospel was spreading vastly and successfully wherever it was being proclaimed. Second, scholars dispute the meaning of the phrase that's often translated to all the nations in Romans 16:26. Many suggest that the preposition in this verse, often translated to, expresses purpose or intent and more accurately conveys the meaning for all nations. The idea is that the gospel is not limited to the nation of Israel or to a particular group of nations. This means that the intended scope of the gospel is all nations, and it does not suggest that it had already accomplished this purpose in the first century. Third, while the Greek word world, oikumene, can refer to the Roman Empire, as it does in Luke 2:1, Acts 11:28, Acts 17:6, Acts 19:27, and Acts 24:5, it does not denote such a limited geographical region in Romans 10:18. Rather, this verse is an allusion to Psalm 19:4, in which the Septuagint translates the Hebrew into Greek, which was written during the reign of King David, not during the time of any civilized empire. This psalm speaks of the heavens and the celestial bodies declaring God's glory to all the earth and to the end of the world. As such, the apostle borrowed the language of this psalm to express the idea that the heavenly message of the gospel is intended for everyone under heaven, including Jews and Gentiles, Romans 10:12-18. Fourth, the phrase translated, which has been proclaimed, Colossians 1:23, is in the aorist tense, which often carries a continuous aspect, and in this case is better translated, which is proclaimed. John Piper explains the implications for the meaning of this verse. Quote, the fact that the substantival participle proclaimed is aorist tense does not mean the proclamation has already happened in the past. That is not the way aorists in substantival participles work, as Daniel Wallace makes clear. The aorist tense is in such uses denotes no specific time. So the simplest reading of Colossians 1:23 is that Paul is defining the gospel as the kind of gospel that is unbounded and global in scope, and therefore is preached by definition in all creation. There is no statement here that it has already happened. So I would translate it, the gospel which is proclaimed in all creation under heaven. I would happily note that N.T. Wright suggests the same interpretation. End quote. The figurative language employed by Paul and his traveling companion Luke to describe the non-discriminate intent and victory of the gospel contrasts with the literal meaning of Jesus' words in Matthew 24:14. There is no compelling reason to interpret the master's words in the latter in a hyperbolic manner. Instead, the gospel will be proclaimed to all nations, that is, to all ethnic groups throughout the world, in order to provide them with legal testimony prior to the judgment at the end of the age, a judgment which will include all nations, according to Matthew 25:32. The book of Revelation also conveys the concept that the everlasting gospel must be proclaimed to every nation and tribe and language and people prior to the glorious revelation of Jesus Christ, Revelation 14:6. On the other hand, the preterist approach to Matthew 24:14 imports an unintended meaning upon the words of Jesus and thereby distorts the very basis for worldwide evangelism. This is further supported by the fact that the preterist interpretation of Matthew 24:14 unwittingly undermines the Great Commission, for at least two reasons. First, Jesus promised to be with his disciples in their evangelistic endeavors until the end of the age, an age that many preterists believe ended with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Second, Jesus commanded his disciples to make disciples of all nations. Based on their interpretation of all nations in Matthew 24:14, and their placement of the end in the ancient past, hermeneutical consistency demands that preterists understand this commandment as having been fulfilled no later than AD 70. In addition, preterists cannot demand that we import the meaning of Pauline passages unto the all nations while arguing that this exact language means something very different when it appears a few chapters later in the same gospel. Other preterist arguments, such as Kick's contention that Matthew 24:14 is about witnessing and the Great Commission is about making disciples, are unconvincing. Even Sproul famously taught that the solitary imperative for Christian evangelism is the command of Jesus in the Great Commission. Consequently, a Great Commission, supposedly fulfilled in AD 70, leaves preterists without the primary imperative for worldwide evangelism. This is Chastity signing off to grab the highlighter and highlight some stuff.